The big goal that we have above all else is market education. For many holders of what we buy, they are not aware that they even have it. And so as you think about many holders, everyone has a tax asset. The question is it big enough for someone to want to buy it?
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com. Today on the show, I have the pleasure of speaking with Andy Lee. Now, Andy founded Parallaxis Capital in 2017, and previously he was with Lone Star Funds, focusing on investing in the Americas. He began his career at Citigroup, but he's also been featured in a number of publications, including the Wall Street Journal, Capital Allocators, Institutional Investor, NBC, and Forbes. He's spoken at many, many events across the United States, and he has a very, very special niche in an alternative asset manager specializing in TRAs, which we're going to get into later in this show. It's a rapidly emerging market, an asset class that has jumped from $8 billion to over $30 billion in market share value in just 5 years. But I'm really excited and pumped to have Andy on the show today. So enough of me, let's get him out here. G'day, Andy. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today, mate?
Good. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, with every question and every guest we like to have on the show, can you rewind the clock and tell me how you made your first ever dollar as a kid?
The first dollar I ever made was being effectively a supermarket back when I was a kid. I had the opportunity to go to boarding school for a year. And during that time, my dad would obviously send me off to school with supplies and my favorite foods. And I found out that others might not have had that same opportunity, primarily because their parents just didn't visit them as frequently as mine did. And so I would get, for no cost, a bunch of, let's say, ramen noodles from my dad, and then sell them all for $1 a piece to my various classmates. And so that was how I made my first dollars. A funny story that I have is that I used to sell Coke in the gallon bottle, and people would start stealing it from my bottle in the fridge in the common area. And so I started getting peeved by that and decided to put rat poison in one of those bottles. That obviously resulted in, it wasn't a ton of it, but it got someone sick. And so the headmaster had a couple of words for me in that regard. So that ended that experiment real freaking fast.
Wow.
That was my first dollar made. Me trying to reduce spoilage ultimately resulted in that business venture not getting very far off the ground.
Yeah, wow. That's I don't know if that's awesome or that's terrifying in the fact that you're trying to poison your classmates, I guess, into stealing your Coca-Cola. But hey, to every one of their own, and it obviously stopped, but it stopped your lucrative venture as well. Andy, tell me a little bit about your upbringing and your relationship with money and sort of, you know, what's the story? I mentioned earlier on you have spent a bit of time in corporate America before starting Parallaxis Capital in 2017. So what was that journey like for you along the way to becoming an entrepreneur?
Absolutely. I think the adage that I would hearken to is a dollar saved is a dollar made. And in that regard, I was very frugal, almost to a fault, as a kid. One of my obsessions growing up was Pokemon cards and buying and procuring Pokemon packs for as cheaply as possible. And so there was once a opportunity for that we went into a store. My mom offered, as a result of good results on grades, that she would buy me a pack, and it was $4.99. And I said, "Mom, if you wouldn't mind, I would happily keep the four cents, and we can just go down the block and buy it for $4.95." Obviously, the shopkeeper didn't want to lose the sale and was kind of embarrassed that we don't have to save 4 cents on it. And so in that regard, he gave me the pack for $4.95. But I think in that element, slowly but surely, I think there were levels of exposure. Might that be building a small supermarket to saving money, that I learned a lot about businesses concepts such as revenue, costs, but also working capital, that slowly flamed my interest in going into business longer term.
Did you have any people in your family around you that were entrepreneurs, your parents, uncles, aunties, cousins?
Sadly, no. In that regard, my dad's a professor in artificial intelligence. Don't ask me. I barely know how to turn on a computer. So in that regard, very useless. My mom was an accountant. And so I did learn a number of elements as to how it was balancing a balance sheet, among others, where things became a little bit familiar from an income statement and cash flow statement, as well as a balance sheet perspective. But as it pertains to the nuts and bolts of unit economics, one, and ultimately two, earning money and ultimately keeping money and sustaining a business and driving growth, those were not elements that my parents were very familiar with and things that I learned from the School of Hard Knocks, as we know, all know it.
What was the impetus to leave corporate America? Why did you want to go off and start Parallaxis Capital in 2017? And talk about that inner mind struggle that a lot of entrepreneurs want to do, but never ultimately take the plunge. So what pushed you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there were two elements that made my journey simpler than most other journeys. The first of which is I knew it was inevitable that I would leave. The question was what? And so it was always a question as to when would I find an idea that I would have significant conviction around to be able and willing to make the plunge, and when was the right time in your career? And I think the adage that I think I heard from many was that there's never a right time. Everything's a bad time. And so I knew that I needed to do it earlier rather than later, because the opportunity costs and the golden handcuffs that came with being in corporate America only grew. They never shrunk. And so that was one element. The second element was my old firm. I had been innovating on the edges with a number of opportunities. And so one of them was, if you thought that drones were inevitable in our lifetimes, then you would try to buy all the air rights along the Hudson. And anytime Bezos flies a drone across the Hudson here in New York City, you would charge him a toll. Unfortunately, public easements in Liberty State Park, as well as the George Washington Bridge, blew a large hole in our investment thesis. And so that went down the drain. What got off the ground was an opportunity called tax receivable agreements, where we created and monetized those assets. And the firm said, this is fascinating. Someone should provide third-party liquidity for this. And I said, wonderful. We can deploy $100 million a year, thinking that was a big number. For a firm that is north of $100 billion, that's a rounding error. And so in that regard, several of the partners basically said, Andy, you've always talked about doing something. Why don't we just give you some money to go do it? And if it doesn't work, come back in 2 years. Think about this as your MBA. And I was like, that's interesting. And so 7 years ago, I left. We've since raised 6 flagship funds, and we have about $500 million under management. And that's all we do, monetizing tax assets for primarily private equity, co-investment, and management team members.
That's incredible that you have your bosses telling you to go off and start your own company. They're
trying to get rid of me, probably.
Yeah, right. It's just like he's definitely going to be back, coming back through this door. Let's give him some money. But let's dig in a little bit to tax receivable agreements. For the layman out there, what is it? How does it work? How do you make money on it?
So think about it almost like a musical royalty or a healthcare royalty that one and some people have been buying more recently. Think about a musical royalty for a Taylor Swift era concert. She might have, alongside with the song, sold her royalties or packaged her royalties to her songwriter, her musicians, as well as the recording album, might that be a Universal. And so each of these individuals may want to hold on to these assets, annuity-like assets, for 70 years, or they may just want to sell them and get money today. There were, as a result of COVID, as you can probably appreciate, a lot of musicians who could no longer go on tour, but they had this valuable recording that spat off YouTube royalties, among others, that they wanted to sell and monetize. That's effectively what we do. But we do it for tax assets And we do it for names such as a Remax, a Shake Shack, a Duff & Phelps, large public obligors who are oftentimes investment grade and near investment grade.
So when you're saying tax receivable agreements, walk me through the exact element of those businesses that you're selling as an annuity to the average investor.
Absolutely. So our investors are primarily endowments and foundations as a core group of LPs. On the flip side, what we deliver them is an uncorrelated return that is cash yielding in nature and serves as a call option in and around corporate tax rates. If I think about a tax asset, everyone has a tax asset. Here in the US, you read file for your taxes on April 15th, and the IRS might say, Reed, you've been a wonderful citizen of the US where you actually overpaid your taxes. And now we owe you a $1,000 refund. A firm like an H&R Block or and whatnot might say, Reed, instead of waiting 2 months for your $1,000, we'll give you $900 today. And you might be like, why not? Like, I much rather simplify my life and not have to wait for that check in the mail. So let me just sell it on to someone else. What we effectively do is similar to how many of your real estate investors have received step-ups upon consummation of a transaction, and as a result, get depreciation benefits from a real estate property. These public companies are also beneficiaries of such transactions and effectively are looking for liquidity. And so we effectively step into the shoes and say, instead of waiting 27 and a half years for that structure to depreciate, we'll give you money right now, delivering you dollars today in return for hopefully more money over time for our investors. So I'm taking credit risk among others associated with that underlying tax asset, but it's a significant, the largest opportunity set that most have never heard of. But tax permeates our society. It's part of the social fabric. It provides for our daily lives, our work, the public infrastructure that we travel on. And so it's a significant opportunity set that commercial capabilities have yet to encroach on.
Gotcha. So just so I'm repeating it back to you, you used the 27 and a half year depreciation, straight line depreciation for a business, right? They own assets, physical, that they want to depreciate over time. And you're essentially giving them that accelerated depreciation as a lump sum in cash. Like, I'm one of these corporations, I own $10 million in assets and I want to depreciate that quicker. Instead of depreciating over 27 years, you're giving me the equivalent of whatever the tax basis is as a lump sum payment upfront, correct?
Multiply that. Think about that as your volume every given year of depreciation. Multiply that by the corporate tax rate. So call it 21 plus your estate rate. So let's just say it was $100 of depreciation. The state, corporate, federal and state rate is 25%. Think about that as $25 of cash tax savings annually. And we're giving, for over 27 and a half years, we're giving them money today in return for that. Yes.
For that portion. Gotcha. No, thank you for clarifying that. And is that then used on your investors? Are that your investors, endowments, foundations, are they looking for tax benefits, hence why they're buying it?
Less so. They don't. Most of our investors are not taxpayers altogether. And so they're looking just for cash flow. So think about that tax savings, what that $25 of tax savings. The company is just basically, instead of paying it to the IRS, they avoid $25 of taxes as a result of that depreciation. They just turn around and send it back to us. And so it's just like a credit product that we are factoring.
Gotcha. And what type of yield are you producing on the money you're putting out the door in these different assets?
We're in the high teens, low 20s.
Yeah, that's right. And is there any sunset to these, these funds?
They expire. Our funds expire in 8 years with several extensions. These assets obviously are longer dated. So we don't buy them typically at inception. We buy them several years in. So instead of, we don't have to hold them for 27 and a half years, we might only be holding them for 10 years.
Gotcha. And how long and how big is this industry? Like in terms of who your players and secondary, it sounds like you're buying these on the secondary market from someone else who's gone and done the hard work on the first, call it 15 years of this 25 years. And then you're coming in the back, the tail end of it, correct?
Yeah, it's primarily private equity firms. Mm-hmm. So they run the gamut, primarily mega funds. So think of the likes of a Blackstone and Apollo, a Hellman and Freeman, among others. Are names that are sophisticated enough to understand the opportunity. The entire opportunity, as you can probably appreciate, is created by the migration of investors away from active management to passive management. And so individuals are these passive investors, might that be ETFs or mutual funds, are very algorithmic or portfolio weighted towards momentum, among others. They don't discriminate for assets that have large tax benefits. And
hey guys, this is a quick ad for our latest multifamily investment opportunity called the Avalon Apartments, located in Dallas, Texas, the fastest growing MSA in the nation. Now, rapid fire, here are the three reasons why we love this asset. Firstly, great investor returns of over 20% annualized. The second thing, of the 226 units, 30% have already been renovated and they're achieving a $250 rental premium. Now, our business plan is pretty simple. We'll come in and renovate the remaining 70% to achieve those proven rental levels, then rely on a modest 3% rent growth thereafter. It's very conservative, very straightforward, and the same thing we have been doing successfully for over a decade. Now, last thing, pricing for multifamily apartment properties have fallen more today than they did during the 2008 global financial crisis. This could very well be the best time in commercial real estate cycle to pick up cheap assets. If you're interested to find out more, click on the link below.
So think about two equivalent businesses. Let's just say one place, a piece of real estate is in an OZ zone and is eligible for low-income housing tax credits. That should make it more valuable than the comparable same asset down the street that doesn't have the benefit of either of those programs.
Mm-hmm.
In the gotcha. Public markets, passive investors don't care for either of them. And so there is incredible value to be captured as a result that large private equity firms are extracting for themselves.
Gotcha. And it's very, very, very interesting. And I assume as a fund manager, once you buy these things, like you're not doing actually much work because the, you know, it's the company, it's the existing company, but I'm sure you'd have some sort of due diligence on these companies that you want to buy these tax receivable agreements from. So what are typically you looking for when you're approaching in the secondary market, when you're trying to buy it from someone, another private equity firm that's already done the hard work, they've negotiated with whatever the, you know, AAA credit rating, you know, business is, then what are you doing? You're coming in and buying it from them.
So these assets, typically we're buying it several years into when they were first originated. And think about us almost like a credit secondary player in that regard. When we look at these assets, we have the benefit of having seen them in the market, publicly traded for, call it 5+ years. And so we look at that, we're like, okay, we can understand your business model. Now the question is, and can we can understand that from a credit, a legal, as well as a tax perspective. And so we can do diligence. Most of our personnel come from the private equity world. And so in that regard, our diligence is private equity light, not like, but light. And so understanding the durability of that business model, obviously the more recurring revenue in nature, the more it's obviously favorable to us. But we believe this. My old firm had a date whereby there is a price for every risk. Obviously, it just might not be a price that the seller might transact at. But our goal is that we are able to underwrite the underlying risk and get paid for that risk.
Gotcha. Is there any, what's the word I'm looking for, swings and roundabouts and is it more to do with the individual businesses that are backing these tax savings from, or is it more to do with the macro market in general, you know, higher interest rates?
So there is one macro risk that I would highlight for your consideration. That's around, in the same way, if tax rates were to go up, that would be a benefit to us. because obviously that would trigger more tax savings. If tax rates were to go down, then we would garner less tax savings. So that's a big macro factor. The second element on the macro front is around interest rates. I would articulate that when we're looking to deliver an uncorrelated return, agnostic of market participations. And so like for us, we typically originate these assets in the high teens, low 20s. And so like we are not totally insulated from interest rate moves, but that is a core part of what we're trying to deliver. Because like our LPs don't want to see that, they want an asset that is durable in nature and that doesn't swing around quarter to quarter based upon where rate moves are. So those would be the macro items that I might highlight. The micro elements being the performance of the companies, that fundamental is fundamental underwriting that we undertake as a firm.
Gotcha. Got it. But these are publicly traded companies which have many, many years of data that you can go and call upon to see where they're going to, where they're coming from, and all that sort of good stuff and make stuff. Are you getting leverage on these acquisitions, or is all cash, all equity?
We've historically gotten some leverage against it. We do not today, but that's something that we are contemplating in the near future. It's all entirely around rates and attachment points.
Gotcha. So you're producing, did you say high teens annually or IRR?
For us, so think about it as our discount rate equals our IRR. Our cash yield on any given year tends to be wide of that because we're capturing some level of amortization. So if we're originating at a 20% discount rate, we're probably capturing almost a 25% cash yield on cash.
That's fantastic. With no debt, like that's an incredible return. I'm sure a lot of people are interested in jumping in your fund. are you open to the retail investor market, or are you just purely doing institutional right now?
My old firm, unfortunately, doesn't have a ton of retail recognition, primarily because the average deal that the average check that the firm sought to raise money from was about $75 million. And so like the retail investor was not really an avenue through which we were able to gain name recognition around, because they were like, I've heard of Apollo, I've heard of Blackstone. Who in the world is Lone Star Funds? And so as you can probably appreciate, for the retail investor, it's easier to go with the brand names that they are familiar with. We were not one of them. And so from time to time, we have taken in some retail checks, primarily from investors who are highly sophisticated. They might not necessarily be a family office, but they might write $1 million or $2 million check. That's what we have taken. But those have been few and far between given the esoteric nature of our asset class.
Yeah, gotcha. So coming on this podcast, a lot of retail investors listen to this show. What's the goal for you to try and get your name out there and trying to get a little more education around what you do with TRAs and Parallaxis Capital?
Yeah, look, the big goal that we have above all else is market education. For many holders of what we buy, they are not aware that they even have it. And so as you think about everyone has a tax asset. The question is it big enough for someone to want to buy it? In the same way, when I shared the H&R Block example, when people go to Europe, there's a VAT tax refund where there's a big business here in the US called Global Blue that owns that entire, is basically a monopoly in Europe on that side of the pond that just happens to be traded here in the US, where every time you buy something from Hermes, and your wife buys something lovely from Hermes, you might get a 22% refund at the airport. And you're like, wonderful. But you have to wait a month to get the money. Hey, that's money right there. And a firm like a Global Blue factors it. Our goal longer term is to educate the market that everyone has tax assets. And just to be more aware that there are financing solutions associated with them.
Interesting. It's really like accounts payable or credit cards where you know the money's coming in, but you're making an investment on the fact that you're getting reimbursed by you know, whatever the country might be reimbursing that from a tax perspective. So, yeah, no, it's very, very interesting. I will ask you where people can reach you at the end of the show. But with that, what's the goal over the next 12 to 18 months as you're coming into, you know, what do you want to do with Parallaxis Capital and how you want to grow in the next little while?
So we've been very focused in the first 7 years of Parallaxis on our product. We've not done a great job of our go-to-market and educating investors on our value proposition, one, and two, that they even hold these assets. And so we are on a journey to recruit personnel who are best in class in getting in front of, but more importantly, staying in front of these investors who might be selling these assets in order to educate them as to the value of those assets, as well as the liquidity solution that we are going to be bringing to bear. Those are some of the elements over the next 12 to 18 months that we're incredibly focused on.
Great. Great. Awesome. Well, I'm super excited to see where you guys go from. I want to stay in touch as you grow the platform because it's very, very interesting. And I can tell you what, a lot of the more education you can get out there to retail investors, there'd be a ton of capital relative. Let's all call it relative compared to institutional, but maybe a little bit more easier to get across the line once you get all that education materials out there into the public sphere so people can learn about what you do. Andy, at the end of every show, we love to dive into the top five investing tips. You ready to get into it?
Happy to. Let's do it.
Mate, question number one is, what's the daily habit you practice to keep on track towards your goals?
At the end of every day, I write down what I intend to accomplish the next day. And so in that way, I start the day off fresh, knowing what I need to accomplish. Obviously, as things come in overnight, there are reprioritizations. But without that, I think it enables me to start off very focused as to the highest and most valuable use of my time over the course of the next 24 hours.
That's great. I love it. Do you track it anywhere in particular on an app, on a piece of pen and paper? I'm the same, my friend. Pen and paper. I got to write it down and cross it off. All right.
It's addictive. Your capacity and capability to check something off, and you find like you've accomplished something that day.
Yes, ticking it on a mobile phone screen, it just doesn't have the same effect as crossing it off on a piece of paper. Awesome stuff. Question number two is, who's the most influential person in your career to date?
I would say my dad, insofar that if I think about hard work, in my mind, hard work is a relative term. I've come to find you can work intensely and you can work for a very short duration, or you can have an average work ethic and work for 40 years. I've come to learn that your capacity to work intensely for a very short duration can have extreme outcomes as it pertains to your capacity and capability to move ahead in life. And so watching my dad, whenever he finds interest in a project, attacking it voraciously is something that I've come to learn that can be a superpower.
I love it. Love it. Question number three is, what's the most influential tool in your business? Now, when I say a tool, it could be a physical tool like your phone or a person or your team or a journal, or it could be a piece of software that you just can't run the business without. What is it?
I think the elements is we have for our team a very large outsourced element in both India and the Philippines that work around the clock for the benefit of our firm. As a small firm, being able to leverage such global resources obviously is incredibly valuable from a time perspective, one, but also a cost perspective. And it's been rewarding to find these individuals, train them, retain them, and pay them because our dollar is able to go significantly further, but also raising their standard of living and capabilities because most people think of offshore resources and you think of something that are secretarial in nature, many of these individuals have been able to scale alongside us, and we're incredibly proud of their development over time.
I love it. Now, I use a whole underwriting team in India to underwrite every single deal that comes through our door. So, yeah, I couldn't, virtual work and outsourcing is a massive part of building any business from the ground up. It's just being smart with your dollars, as you mentioned earlier. The dollar saved is a dollar earned, as they say. So, with that being said, question number four, in one sentence, what's been the biggest failure and what did you learn from that failure in your career?
there are a ton of failure. Let's just start with that. I always tell my team, if we're not failing, we're not trying hard enough. Like, there, we should not be betting 1,000 on any endeavor. Our job is to be incredibly ambitious. We're going to have a lot of flameouts, but in that same way, we're going to have huge wins in that regard when things work out. And so life is about crawl, walk, run. I don't expect you to hit a home run day one, but my job is to endeavor incredibly hard to drive outcomes. We're going to make them ambitious, and we're going to work incredibly hard in putting a game plan around achieving them that allows us to achieve more than we expected. Yes, we might not have the outcome that we expected, but it's way better than the outcome that we would have if we had been passive about our own development.
Love it. Love it, mate. It's awesome. Awesome stuff. Last question. Where can people reach you to continue the conversation that we're doing in your sphere? Where do they go?
Absolutely. Pretty active on LinkedIn. We've been posting regularly, and we'd love to engage with you and your audience on there.
So Andy Lee on LinkedIn?
Yes, sir.
And if they want to know a little bit more about Apparel Access, on, is there a website they can go to, parallelaccesscapital.com?
Yeah, that's right.
Parallel Access, P-A-R-A-L-L-A-X-E-S, capital.com. Well, Andy, I want to thank you so much for taking some time out of your day. I want to just reflect some of the things I took away. It was like, look, tax receivable agreements, a completely new investment I've ever heard of. I've been doing this for over 10 years, and I've never, ever spoken to anyone talking about TRAs. Hugely important. And I think your journey around educating the wider audience around, one, what maybe tax assets they're sitting on, and two, how the average investor can get involved, I think is very, very powerful. These could be some very powerful tools that can reap really good cash flow for investors just by hearing what you're saying. Nearly, you know, double-digit returns every year on, you know, for many foreseeable years. A lot of our investors who invest in real estate love the cash flow, but cash flow has been harder. So maybe there's another awesome asset like what you're offering at the TRAs over at Parallel Access they can come and learn a little bit more about. But with that, I want to thank you. Is there anything you want to add before we wrap up the show?
No, thank you for you and your time, sir.
Awesome, mate. Well, look, again, thank you so much for taking some time out of your week. Enjoy the rest of your day, and we'll catch up very, very soon.
You will.
Well, there you have another cracking episode jam-packed with incredible advice from Andy. Remember, check him out at Andy Lee on LinkedIn, and remember, parallelaccesscapital.com. If you're interested at all to learn about tax receivable agreements, definitely Google that. Find out some more information about what Andy and his team are doing to educate the wider audience about this as an investment vehicle for you and your family. I want to thank you all again for taking some time out of your day to tune in to continue to grow your financial IQ. We're going to do this all again next week. The easiest way to give back is to give it a 5-star review on iTunes. Check us out at rsnpropertygroup.com. And we're going to do this all again next week. So remember, be bold, be brave, and go give life a crack.